Good morning. A year ago, PV customers were told they'd need permission to install their systems. Following Friday's legislative briefing, Leslie Cole Brooks of the Hawaii Solar Energy Association has an update. What do we owe veterans who gave their lives for our country? Some would argue, at least a headstone. Historian Nanette Napoleon looks at the ongoing controversy to do that. On Monday, September 22nd, it's The Conversation.
And on Maui, a scary film classic moves on stage. Actress Lynn McEwen gives us a warning about Wait Until Dark. And bananas in pajamas may not be on the agenda at the banana workshop at Maui Nui Botanical Gardens, but everything else about them is fair game. We'll talk with Dr. Angela K. Kepler, author of The World of Bananas in Hawaii, then and now. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Those conversations and a few more right after this news. And that music may give you some indication of our first conversation this morning, which we'll have in just a minute after I say good morning to you, Chris Vanderkirk.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Thinking about the importance of military honors, yeah.
Military honors, and what do we owe veterans who have given their lives for our country? Do we owe them something as simple as a headstone, and how that's been such a frustrated fight for many years since the VA changed the way it rules who can apply for that headstone.
Too many unmarked graves, yeah?
Many, many unmarked graves. In fact, there's one cemetery in New York which has over 1,200 unmarked graves. Well, actually, they have a little yellow flag on them. That's just about it. And that's what we're going to talk about this morning because, yes, Hawaii has a stake in this too. Now, as we mentioned a moment ago, a couple of years ago in 2012, a rule change at the Department of Veterans Affairs meant that only the next of kin could request a headstone for a soldier's unmarked grave. Up until that time, anyone in the funerary business could have asked for a headstone. The issue, as we mentioned, is particularly noticeable in that cemetery in New York, but Hawaii also has an issue with this, as there are some who've been trying to get Private Kealoha, Civil War veteran soldier who was killed and has been lying in an unmarked grave, a marker for a very long time. Historian Nanette Napoleon joins us now to let us know what's been happening with this. Good morning.
Good morning to you all.
You know, it's interesting to note how you've been able to make this happen for Private Aloha's, Hake Aloha's grave, but not going necessarily through the VA because of this controversy, and despite the fact that there have been at least a couple of pieces of legislation that have been introduced last year and this year to make changes. Really a very frustrating situation for many folks.
Yes, you're right. Our little campaign to get Private J.R. Kealoha, a native Hawaiian from the islands who fought in the American Civil War, a marker, has been a more than a year-long campaign for us. And so we're just a small part of this larger campaign going on across the country to change legislation which was implemented by the Veterans Administration Department back in 2012, like you said, which virtually stopped the efforts on private individuals' parts, such as our little hui going on here, and groups across the country, hundreds of groups across the country who have, since the Civil War, been applying for and receiving markers on behalf of Civil War soldiers without next of kin that can be identified. And over these years, tens of thousands of markers have been issued in this way, but 2 years ago, the federal government decided to disallow non-next of kin.
Why did they do that? I mean, it seemed like for so many, many years, that was not
the practice. Yeah, it wasn't an issue. So all of a sudden, they're saying, oh, it's because some people have been complaining that they've taken issue with non-relatives marking what might be their relatives' graves, and what right do we, groups like us, have to mark these unmarked graves. But
there is the issue, though, of knowing that the grave exists. I mean, some of these people have been dead for a very long time.
Yeah.
I mean, J.R.K. Aloha has been gone for 137 years.
That's right.
How do you know that the next of kin is going to be able to know that this grave exists and be willing to take action? And is their failure something that the country should absorb as a failure?
That's right. And how do we know that they even had any kind of next of kin? Obviously, somebody who served in the Civil War, there's going to be no parents, no grandparents. We don't know if Ke Aloha, like many of those soldiers, if they had siblings, if they had aunts and uncles. We don't know any of that. So it's speculative at best for us. We think that to say that there might be, there's a long shot that there might be a descendant somewhere, but he's been sitting there without anybody marking his grave for 137 years, so it seems unfair for him not to be able to get a bona fide government-issued marker.
Now, you tried to do this. You tried to sort of, you know, skirt the changes in 2012 a little bit, and they told you no dice on that one, too.
Yeah, you know, we knew that the law had been changed in 2012, but we wanted to just make a point to apply anyway. We knew 99.9% we would get rejected, and we did get rejected. But we wanted to make a point, as others across the country have been doing. They've been applying for markers knowing full well they're going to get rejected, but making the point that we are out here, we're not going to stop trying to pressure the VA office to make changes by submitting all these applications anyway and making them still have to look at the issue, right?
Now, as they may or may not be looking at the issue, we mentioned just a moment ago that there are, there have been at least a couple of attempts at creating some legislation, but not really good odds at that legislation actually becoming law. So what happens now for a lot of these markers at that one cemetery in New York where there are over 1,200
right.
Civil War veterans lying with little, you know, dinky plastic yellow flags marking their grave.
Right. What
really can be done, and is the VA listening?
Well, you know, it can. Any legislation can be changed if the right supporters are behind it. And the latest one to come to the forefront is one that I sent you from, is it Senator Rob Portman of Ohio and...
Right, from this summer.
Yes. And so, you know, other senators and representatives in Congress have been involved over the last couple of years and looking at this issue. But I think this one, I think, has the best chance because it... I like the last part of it that says, let me quote this, if a deceased veteran served on active duty in the armed forces at least 75 years before the date on which the headstone or marker is requested, any individual can request a headstone. So I think this is kind of a good compromise, saying that we're going to open it up to any individual or group, but there's a 75-year window thing.
A cap to it.
And I think that's fair. Before, we didn't have anything about 75 years. It could be there was no year requirement, right? So I think this is an attempt, a good attempt at compromising, and I think it has a fairly good chance. But, you know, we'll see.
Well, you're talking about the Honor of Those Who Served
yes.
Act of 2014,
yes.
which is a little different from the one that came out last year in 2013, and the difference is that 75-year window, but still, this thing is now in committee, and no really real word yet on whether this thing is moving
right.
or really not moving. And you know, some who have been tracking this, I'm thinking about, you know, there's a website that does a lot of transparent tracking of legislation at the federal level, and govtrack.us says that it really gives it maybe a 2% chance
oh,
of making
really?
It through.
I didn't see that. 2%.
A 2% chance, which is not sounding good, and it goes back to that same issue of really what do we owe these veterans,
mm-hmm.
and why is it that they're going to simply have these little yellow flags until the VA changes its policy or not. Meanwhile, though, you do have a marker that you got privately for J.R. Kealoha, and you're going to be unveiling that next month?
Next month, October 25th, from 10 to 11 o'clock at Oahu Cemetery, where he's buried.
And that may be where, I guess, some of this has to go, back to the private sector and people who care.
Right. So our plan C was, knowing full well that this would happen, is that we would get him a private marker. And so we were thinking about ways we could raise funds to do that. And then we ended up getting, luckily, Honor Life Memorials in Kahului to donate a free marker, a free beautiful granite marker with the inscription included on it, which has his name, his regiment, his rank, and the date he died on it. And so we're very, very grateful to Honor Life Memorials for stepping up to the plate and doing that.
We'll have to see others who will want to do something similar if the same policy with the VA stays in force. Thanks so much for giving us an update. We'll be watching this. Thanks for joining us this morning, Nanette. Nanette Napoleon is a freelance historical researcher, writer, and Hawaiian cultural specialist. She's well known for her extensive work documenting historical graveyards in Hawaii and has been involved with trying to get a marker for J.R. Kealoha, Civil War soldier, gone now 137 years. She's been involved with that for the last couple of years.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:15 and coming up, a slow-burning story of suspense. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're remembering a rustic mountain lodge built in part on the remnants of a Maui military installation. It was opened in August 1947 as an official part of Hawaii National Park. Its cabins were converted from abandoned structures that became the property of the Department of the Interior after the end of the Second World War. The department granted a business concession permit to create a visitor attraction to take advantage of the spectacular mountain views the site offered. The original managers were a brother and sister team, Robert Van Temsky and Alexa Van Temsky-Zabriski. They opened a mountain lodge in style with a VIP reception and a horseback excursion for guests. The renovated dining room seated 60, and room rates ran as low as $7.50 a night. It's fondly remembered by Kama'aina, and we're wondering if you can tell us its name. Post it on Twitter at HI Conversation if you know. We'll be back with the answer later in the hour.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting An Evening with Soul and Gospel Singer Mavis Staples, 7:30 p.m. this Thursday in Castle Theater. MauiArts.org.
Suspense stories make great theater when the tension is timed just right, building to a climax that is all the more startling because it's being acted out live in front of us. There's a good deal of craft that goes into keeping that suspense alive, and when it's applied to a proven winner like the play Wait Until Dark, the effect is pretty powerful. Maui on Stage is bringing that classic to its stage with Lynn McEwen in the role of Susie, and she's on the line this morning. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. challenging role for you, for just about anybody, yeah?
Yes. I think any time that you take away sight,
one of the senses,
particularly on stage.
No kidding, yeah. And now, in this character, Susie has not always been blind, right?
No, she's been blind just over a year.
So that's a very different adaptation, obviously, than a lifelong condition.
Yes, and it definitely affects how you have to play her, because there are certain things that, of course, she would be doing because she's blind, but there are certain movements, facial expressions, and such that are present because she hasn't spent her entire life blind. And she's also still learning about her blindness and her abilities.
And so there would be a lot more uncertainty than for somebody who had been blind all their life.
Yes, I do think that that's the case.
Well, how does that play out for you? I mean, you obviously have to, you're in a very vulnerable situation. You're under a threat from, is it three men who come to you, into your home?
Yes. Yeah, there are three, and I don't want to give too much away about the plot, but she's sort of aware of the threatening nature to some degree of one or two of them and not really of the other. It's sort of a cat-and-mouse game, but with a bit of a con aspect to it. So, and meaning con as in tricking someone, not convict, but although that is an aspect of it as well. But yes, it's a play in which the vulnerability is one of the central aspects, particularly also because it is in the 1960s as well. So there is that added dynamic of a woman under threat from these three men, sort of right at that the threshold of the feminist revolution. It's a really interesting play from that side because she becomes empowered in a way through this experience. Of course, I can't tell you what happens exactly, but you know, that's part of the whole cat and mouse thing.
Well, she's being, by at least one of the men, she's being conned, or he's pretending to be something very much other than what he is, right?
That is correct, yes.
And she eventually learns to, in a way, the whole thing of waiting until dark is waiting until the playing field is a little bit more leveled out. They can't see either, right?
Exactly. There's a turning the tables component.
So she does come into her own as a protagonist, as an antagonist in the course of this, yeah?
Yeah, I would say it still stays pretty firmly in the protagonist.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah.
Yes, but there definitely is a point in which she sort of finds some strength and is able to to try to even the playing field a bit.
Well, I think that whole dynamic in the plot sort of elevates this particular story from the standard woman in Jeopardy horror flick, right?
Oh, very much so, yeah. It's not, all entirely some, oh, poor little girl being victimized. I think that in some ways she sort of finds her strength partially because of what happens in the play. There's she is pushed to her limits, but she does try to rise to the occasion.
For
rather
you,
than it's not simply running from something.
So for you, at the beginning of the play, you have to sort of wait your portrayal more toward the vulnerability side, and then as the action progresses, move toward the empowered, yeah?
I think the vulnerability probably falls more a little bit, maybe the real height of that is more in the center, because in the beginning, the play is set in her apartment, mm-hmm. and it is where she is comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that, and then when danger is so very, very imminent and is threatening, then she's at her vulnerability. But that comes in sort of more to the beginning and center of the piece.
You have to see her and get to know her as comfortable first, and then the fall from that becomes that much more dramatic, yeah?
Yes, you can certainly see that it's not something that she's certainly not used to the blindness completely yet, but within the confines of her own apartment, it is as comfortable as she is.
And, of course, it's that familiarity with her surroundings that's going to play out in the third act, yeah?
Yes, indeed.
Well, working on this with the other actors, how did that work out in terms of just kind of blocking and knowing where everybody was? Was that a bit of a struggle?
It's so much more complicated than anything I've ever been, and my hat is so very much off to Dale Button, who's directing it, because the intricacy of the blocking and the lighting and just every aspect, every tiny bit of the technical aspect of this is so incredibly important. It's not something where you can simply say, oh, well, you know, I feel that I might move here, because things have to go where they go. It's extremely, extremely intricate. And it's also so much fun. I mean, working with the other actors on this has been fantastic, and it's certainly pushed me and challenged me in ways that I hadn't even imagined that it would. And it's been a really great time. And the physical part of it, it's just fun.
I bet. Well, Lynn, we've got to go, but
it's taxing.
I'm sure.
It's fun.
Well, good luck with the show, and thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so very much for having me.
You bet. Lynn McEwen plays Susie in the Maui Onstage production of Wait Until Dark, the play by Frederick Knott. It runs from September 26th to October 5th at the historic Iao Theater, and you can find out more about the production at hpr2.org.
Something a little less scary. At Hawaii Public Radio, we're dedicated to bringing you more excellent radio and less on-air fundraising. Early giving for Celebration 2014 can help us return to programming within the allotted days, maybe even earlier. That's up to you. We gratefully acknowledge Norma Bryce of Honolulu, Paul and Marie Kodama of Aiea, and Virginia Fine of Kailua. Thank you all for your early gifts for Celebration 2014. And now, if you've yet to donate, it could be your turn. New members frequently join us at the $10 a month True Believer level. All you have to do is click on the support link on hpr2.org. With 6 weeks to the general election, Civil Beat is releasing its latest poll. Today, we'll look at the results of the gubernatorial race, at least of what they think could possibly happen. And now it looks like it's a two-candidate contest. Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Oh, happy Monday, Beth Ann.
And a good Monday to you. Certainly for those who are looking at this poll in the Ige camp and seeing that 4 percentage point lead over Republican Duke Ayona. And also for those who might have been saying that Mufi Hanneman was really going to be a spoiler, this looks like, well, maybe not.
So the numbers are 43% for David Ige, 39% for Duke Ayona, and yes, just 8% for Mufi Hanneman running as an independent candidate, although I did talk to someone from his campaign the other day, and they said, you know what, it's still early in so many ways. As a matter of fact, a series of debates is beginning. In fact, don't you guys have the HPR? Is your debate tonight?
Tonight.
That's right. So there's a whole bunch of possibilities for voters to see these folks. But for now, it's a slightly comfortable lead for David Ige. Another good sign from the poll for him is that he did as well among people who voted for him in the primary as voted for Abercrombie. In other words, there seems to be sort of a, well, I guess we're going to stick with the Democrats and be loyal.
Well, and that's part of it, loyalty factor. And initially, as all of this was coming out, and clearly we've got 6 weeks to go to see how that loyalty factor may feel impact from Mufi Hanuman as we move through. That was such a big talking point of, you know, will this in fact act in a way to split Democrats in some fashion? And it seems from this, at least, that, well, maybe that's not such a factor.
Right. We'll see how that turns out. Certainly, Ige was helped by Neil Abercrombie's rather gracious concession in the primary. You know, a couple of other things that came from the poll that surprised me was that there was actually a significant crossover vote. Republicans voting for Ige in the primary, in other words, pulling the Democratic ballot. Why they did that, who knows? Perhaps they thought Ige would be a weaker candidate than Abercrombie, but there was a significant crossover vote, so that could be something that could factor into the general.
Well, and as we, you know, because at that point in time, that won't really be a possibility.
Right, exactly. They will stick with Iona, but it really does appear to be a two-person race. It's just a 3% margin of error. A couple of other things that stood out. Ige did better among female voters. Iona better among male.
And ethnicity?
Very interesting. Well, actually, probably not surprising at all. Japanese Americans favored David Ige, who's Japanese American, and Duke Iona was favored by Native Hawaiians, and Iona is Hawaiian. By the way, both of them have running mates of the same ethnicity, Shan Tsutsui and Elwin Ahu.
So that may very well be a factor, too, as we continue on and see who goes to what camp. We'll continue to take a look at this and some of the other poll results that you got later on this week.
I'll be back tomorrow. Thanks, Beth Ann.
Thanks, Chad. Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com.
Good morning, I'm Chris Vandercook, and it's 8:30. You're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. If you want to be in touch, there are plenty of options. Post your comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR. And you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, we're talking about liver disease, yeah?
Yes, we are. In particular, we're going to talk about the new CDC guidelines for having people get checked for exposure to hepatitis C. It's a silent infection for most folks until it gets very advanced. So we're going to talk about why those guidelines came out, who they apply to, and why it's an extremely important thing to get done at your next doctor's visit.
So baby boomers and slightly post-baby boomers are most at risk, yeah?
That's the group. We're seeing that, you know, hepatitis C in some cases can cause liver failure. And the highest rate of new diagnoses of liver failure are coming from this hepatitis C group. And that particular group doesn't know they have it until it's very advanced. So those born between 1945 and 1965 absolutely ought to get tested. But particularly here in the islands, those who were born in Asia should be tested regardless of their age, in addition for hepatitis B as well. So new information coming out that we need to act on.
Well, those born in Asia, any behavioral risk factors, you know, dietary or any?
It's just geography. It just happens that in those particular areas, there's a very high incidence of hepatitis B and in some cases C, and it could be transmission when you're born and you never have any symptoms. But if you don't know you have it, you might miss the opportunity to treat it when you can cure the problem rather than waiting until it's too advanced and you don't have the chance to do that.
Sounds as if testing is a very good idea, Kathy.
Absolutely, essential.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
Remember this time last year when HECO told its customers they'd need permission to install their PV systems? Well, many PV buyers were frustrated, and there were warnings of the layoff effect HECO's edict would have on the PV industry. As we went into the weekend, lawmakers held a briefing to look at the status of the issue now, as 4,500 customers are still waiting. One of the groups to present was the Hawaii Solar Energy Association. Leslie Cole Brooks is its executive director, and she's here with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here again.
Well, but maybe not
sort
so
of.
Great to be talking
actually
about
not
an
so
issue
great to be here again.
That, as we've watched over this last year, has been really felt by your industry. So let's go back a little bit and talk about kind of how this happened, in obviously great part because of the aging grid, but because of a little thing called a microinverter, which is what was responsible for what turning solar energy into something that your appliances can use, right?
Right, and right now, on top of everything else, with the slowdown that we've been enduring since last fall, which has been profound for customers, for industry, for the state, there is a new requirement now that inverters be retrofitted for a new frequency setting, and this is for overall reliability on the grid. It's been done before, but it's the size of the retrofit that's being asked for at this point, which is of great concern to us.
Size in terms of number of homes?
Yeah, the number of homes. Some of these inverters can be retrofitted or changed to this new frequency just online. It's a pretty simple process. But they're asking for about 85% of every single installed and operational inverter to be retrofitted, and that means about 20,000 homes here on Oahu. So it's a lot of people, as I've been saying, you know, a lot of dogs that need to be tied up and calls that need to be made. Someone needs to go out to the home, get permission, find out whether or not it's even possible, and then the cost. And this is what needs to be done to move forward. And we're just very concerned about the time and it's going to take to do that and how.
Yeah, the cost in time and in dollars. Yeah. Because even if you could do, what, five of them or so a week, you're still pushing into 2016 before you get everybody done.
Right. And time is really our enemy right now. You know, the plans that have been put in place with these utility, the latest kind of form of the IRP, there's a lot of good things there. And down the road, it looks promising. But the problem is what's going to happen in this next year? And time really is the enemy for us because of the slowdown and now these new requirements. And we're all working up against the federal tax credit, which is due to expire at the end of 2016 for residential systems. So now should be when we're making the very most of this gift, basically, from the federal government. It's a 30% gift that's going to expire. And it's just really a shame to think that we're mired now in these technical difficulties.
There was some criticism that HECO should have accounted for this or planned for this before all of this began to happen, and people were encouraged to buy solar, and we saw the flurry of all kinds of, you know, adverts for it, and people were talking about it because of the federal tax credit, all of that happening. And the question really is now, did HECO have a plan to present on Friday that all of you looked at and thought would work?
I don't think so, no. And it's no surprise that solar energy has grown over the last years and that something needed to be done, or at least to get out onto the circuits and do measurements and find out what the impact is. I mean, it's true we had the highest penetration in the nation, but it's not like it suddenly happened and people woke up and said, oh my goodness, look at what's gone on. And these changes in measurements, they take time to do. And that's what we're looking at right now. So it's not that down the road we can't move forward and continue to take advantage of our indigenous resources, and God bless the folks who've been investing, you know, their own money in these systems. But it's what's gonna happen in the interim. And the plan to get us there right now, I'm very concerned. I don't see really how industry and homeowners are going to move forward in this next year.
Are lawmakers offering any real help in this aside from lip service?
Well, you know, unfortunately, it's not the kind of thing that can be fixed easily. It's not like a lawmaker can just say, make it so, go out and make it so, we're tired of your excuses, because there are legitimate concerns about system-wide reliability and so forth. Although, you know, one of the things I'd like to see happen is one of the alternatives that is becoming very hot right now are people are just saying, you know what, never mind. I'm not gonna export anything. I'm not gonna do that. I'm just gonna have PV. I'm gonna have behind the meter storage. I'm going to take part of the load of my house and just take care of that. I'll still be connected, but I'll just buy less electricity.
Well, is Yego saying that that's okay with them?
Well, I think they should be concerned because, you know, and pushing people in that direction isn't necessarily a good thing. And so there has been some talk about, well, will that be allowed? Is that okay? Because it will change the loads on the systems. But something like putting in a new refrigerator that's more efficient also brings down your load significantly, right? Or if you have someone move out of your house, your load can go down. So it's the same thing. And I think lawmakers could help there to clarify that if a customer wants to install a behind-the-meter storage system that does not export, that doesn't work like how net energy metering has worked, that it's hands-off.
So that's, in a way, a short-term potential fix. But what about everybody who's still left with a system that they can't connect or they can't have installed? I mean, they're still hanging out there in the wind.
They are. They are hanging out there in the wind. And at this point, I don't know. It might be possible maybe that applications could be amended to allow some of these other solutions. But it is tough for people that are in line and for the customers that are still interested. You know, our power bills aren't going down anytime soon. So I know there's still the same amount of interest. So,
and the very next step that you think it has to happen now to move this forward, or is this still very much in a waiting game to see what can happen with a plan to get someone out there to take a look at those inverters?
Well, I think there has to be a plan B, and that's the thing that I think concerns me the most is we can definitely make headway because about half of the inverters that have been asked to be changed out can be done remotely. So we can make a significant improvement and a step towards the system reliability that now has become the concern. But getting the full 200 megawatts that's being asked for is I think it's an enormous undertaking. So where's the plan B? There are all kinds of other solutions, I think, that could be put forward to contend with this issue.
So it sounds like, Leslie, there isn't one at the moment. And
we're still
in a very same place as we were last year, with the exception of the fact that so many people have lost their jobs and
right.
that your industry that we once regarded as being a booming industry is falling. Very quickly.
Right. Thousands of people have lost their jobs. Customers waiting, very frustrated. I think a lot of companies, too, are holding on to their folks. I think there might be another wave of layoffs. You don't want to get rid of your, you know, these people are very highly trained. And, you know, you get your employees, you love them. They're like family. You don't want to let them go. And it's been a very tough situation.
And
so
it looks like that's going to continue for a little while longer.
I think so.
Thank you for joining us this morning, even with not such great news.
Hopefully I'll have good news next time I see you.
Leslie Cole Brooks is the Executive Director of the Hawaii Solar Energy Association.
Today's backyard quiz, we reminded you of a rustic mountain lodge that opened on Maui after the end of the Second World War. The site was dotted with cabins converted from a wartime military installation, and the grounds were on land run by the Department of the Interior's National Park Service. The lodge ran its own bus from the airport to its mountainside location, kept a stable of 40 horses and mules to take guests on excursions. Maui Kama'aina families remember sunset dinners, the spectacular mountain views, and leisurely horseback trips through the area. Winter weather at the lodge's high elevation, with its strong winds, proved the downfall of the enterprise. It became impossible to sustain the visitor attraction as a business during those colder months, and eventually the Haleakala Mountain Lodge and its successor, the Silver Sword Inn, went under. It's 8:44, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Silver Sword. I'm Michelle Dalton from Hilo's performance poetry group Spirit and Flesh here on the Big Island. You're tuned into HBR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HI Conversation.
It's time for Stargazer. Aloha, I'm Dave Lawrence. It's our weekly update of what's happening in our island skies and the world of astronomy. As usual, we're privileged to turn to Christopher Phillips, who is from the Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee, our official connection to the summit there. Hey, Christopher, aloha. What's happening this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, Venus will be visible in the east in the early morning, right about 5:30 a.m. And in the evening sky, we have, of course, Saturn and Mars. Both will be visible from sunset onwards, with Saturn setting around 9:30 p.m., followed shortly by Mars. This week, the moon is approaching its new moon phase, which, of course, means beautiful dark skies here in the island. Tonight, at 7:05 p.m., there will be a bright object appearing in the north at an altitude of about 46 degrees. So that's about halfway up the sky. This bright object will appear out of nowhere. It will get intensely bright, brighter than the brightest planet. You will have to watch closely because it will only be around for about 10 seconds. This bright object is often mistaken for being a UFO, but it is in fact an iridium flare. It is caused by huge antennae on communications satellites reflecting the sun rays.
And finally this week you said that you had a little more on a story that recently broke about augmentation of our mission to space.
That's right. So it's been announced that manned spaceflight is coming back to the United States. Two companies, Boeing and SpaceX, have been given the go-ahead to fly astronauts to and from the International Space Station. Right now, both the U.S. and Europe have to rely on Russian spacecraft to deliver astronauts to the ISS, and Russia has said it will cut access off in a couple of years. What's a matter of concern is just how the Russians will keep the space station operational, because most of the navigational and flight modules are of U.S. origin. Normally, cooperative space missions have been immune from disputes here on Earth. However, times have changed, and Russia has said it will deny access to the space station in retaliation for sanctions levied against it because of its involvement in Ukraine.
So Russia's basically saying they'll cut off any access to the space station, even though it's really not exclusively their property.
Exactly, yeah. But without their spacecraft to fly to and from the Earth,
right,
there's no way of getting there.
Got it.
SpaceX would appear to be the front runner in this. Their spacecraft are cheap, reliable, and innovative, capable of landing back on Earth using rockets instead of parachutes and controlled crash landings, which is basically how Boeing will be returning humans back to Earth.
Thank you for the report, Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee.
You're welcome.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer.
The banana plant in all its varieties has done much to keep the world alive down through the centuries, and there are more varieties of bananas and plantains than most supermarket shoppers can imagine. Dr. Angela K. Kepler is one of the world's leading experts on this abundant and life-giving fruit. She's offering a workshop this weekend at Maui Nui Botanical Gardens, and she joins us by phone. Good morning, Angela. How are you?
Good morning, Chris. I'm just fine, thanks. Beautiful day.
You've certainly found a world of variety in what many would consider to be kind of a single subject, but there's a lot more than one might think, isn't there?
Yeah, there certainly is. Bananas are a lot more than a sliced fruit on your cereal in the morning of an imported Cavendish variety from Ecuador or Costa Rica. And I guess this is one of the reasons why I became a little bit of an ambassador for growing bananas here in Hawaii, and also to alert people to the immense and really previously unrecognized value of bananas, the traditional Maya of the Hawaiians in olden times.
Were the first Maya brought here by the original Hawaiians?
Yes, they were. Bananas are not native to Hawaii. They're actually are native to evolved in Southeast Asia. And Hawaii's particular traditional varieties are mostly from the New Guinea area.
So they're a so-called canoe plant?
They're canoe plants, but, you know, most people think of, oh, sort of a generalized canoe plant. Oh, yes, the banana came and somebody stuck a keiki in the canoe and brought it here and planted it. but this happened over at least two of the major migrations with my husband in my research and work all over the Pacific, piecing together the rare varieties on different Pacific islands, particularly in the Central Pacific. We found that actually the Hawaiians' original about 40 varieties came from all the way back to New Guinea. You can find bananas look almost identical to some of the varieties here in Irianjaya, for instance.
So it really becomes a bit of a detective story in your career.
It was indeed, because unfortunately very, very, very little was known about bananas, both in Hawaii and elsewhere in the Pacific. And so, yes, indeed, it was a detective story, trying to find what I could from the literature, which was very, very little, but basically going to islands and talking to anybody internationally that might know anything about Pacific Island bananas. And so it was a whole open field, and it was very, very exciting for us.
And from studying its history, you've got a whole kind of sense of mission about the future and what can be done with this fairly miraculous plant, yeah?
Well, what I have, except with a caveat of pests and diseases, mm-hmm. you know, with the Taro, the Kalo has pests and diseases, just about everything does, sugarcane.
Sure.
And bananas are also subject to this. And one of the reasons is they're not pure species. The bananas as we know them today, the seedless bananas, most people, you know, don't even think that their ancestors were once seeded.
Yeah.
And so we owe a great debt of gratitude to probably at least 30,000 years of seafaring farmers and island farmers to have chosen the best ones with the most pulp, the tastiest pulp, the fewest seeds, and selecting these all along the way so that by the time the so-called canoe bananas arrived in Hawaii, they were they're seedless, virtually seedless, and very, very tasty.
Are there a number of seeded varieties still around?
You mean in Hawaii or
elsewhere? No, just in general, elsewhere, yeah.
Oh, yeah, there are plenty. In fact, people that are familiar with ornamental bananas, the ones with the upright, pretty pink or orange showy buds, these all have tiny little seeds. You can see some in the ER Valley, for instance, and Hana, Kipulu, some of the older Kama'aina families have some of these ornamental bananas. They're from as far west as India, but yeah, they have little seeded bananas. There's one that's called Fuzzy Pink. That is quite an amazing thing to see, and you open it up.
I would imagine.
Pink and fuzzy, like hot pink and fuzzy, and has these little black seeds and white.
See, this is a world beyond what most people know, and the ones that we see every day in the supermarket, where are they from?
They're basically from Ecuador and Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Enormous, enormous plantations. We also, and of course, with a whole load of pesticides and nematicides and a very, very controlled chemical environment. In fact, perhaps I shouldn't say this, but the bananas and potatoes have some of the largest tonnages of pesticides
because it's
applied to crops, commercial crops.
It's kind of in their physical nature that they absorb these materials.
Yeah, they do. They do indeed, especially the nematicides that are injected into the soil.
Well, I would assume that you're more tended toward what you can grow on your own land, right?
Yes, we are indeed. We're certainly not in the commercial field at all, but at this point I'd like to encourage people to grow commercially grown apple bananas and Williams bananas from the islands here. They may be a little bit more expensive, but they're supporting our local farmers.
Well, if you grow them yourself, they're not that expensive. How hard are they to grow in a backyard environment?
Well, one of the things I'm going to be talking about at the Maui Nui Botanic Garden Workshop is the best varieties to plant, and I think this is very important with the public awareness now of banana bunchy top virus. So we have to be very, very careful of which varieties are going to be most susceptible to the virus.
And which are more resistant.
And the apple bananas, actually, the dwarf, both the dwarf apples of the Santa Catarinas and the tall apple bananas that have been in Hawaii since 1855,
they're pretty good.
Some of the most resistant to the virus.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much, Angela, and we'll look forward to that talk this weekend. Dr. Angela K. Kepler is the author of The World of Bananas in Hawaii, Then and Now. She's giving a workshop this Saturday at Maui Nui Botanical Gardens on the best Hawaiian banana varieties to plant, the keys to their healthy maintenance. And you can learn more at hpr2.org.
Hello, this is Michael Tenneton, proud to lead the fiercely individual Hawaii Public Radio. Unlike many other media organizations, HPR is a non-profit, which means we put most of our budget right back into the services we deliver. Well, our fiercely individual listeners would have it no other way. Now, would you? So, we hope to hear from you during Celebration 2014. Earlier would be good, too. And remember, your donation is tax-deductible. Thanks so much.
Earlier this half hour, we talked with Leslie Cole Brooks about what's been happening, or some would say not happening, regarding all those people left in limbo with their PV systems.
There's quite a potential logistical nightmare in going on to thousands of roofs to reset machinery, yeah?
Well, I mean, that's part of what she was talking about, and that there doesn't really seem to be a plan going forward to be able to do that within a timeline that in her mind won't cause the collapse of the industry. And having watched it over the last year and noting how many commercials are not on television, how many times we don't really hear about it anymore, and how the industry has sort of been kind of quiet about how many people have been laid off and may yet be.
Given all the incentives toward renewables, we'd expect that we'd have a very progressive view on this.
Well, and that was sort of her point. If this is a great disconnect, and by the time all this happens, and all these inverters are checked for safety, then maybe all of this, the federal tax credits will no longer be available. Not a good situation for consumers, nor for all those still left wondering what to do with their systems. We'll keep following that one. Now, tomorrow we'll also be following what's happening with the lava. We'll be talking with a business owner in Pahoa about how she and others are preparing.
And we'll talk with the director of Defensora, an award-winning documentary with special meaning for Hawaii.
You can be in touch with us on email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation.
And our past shows are on the HPR2 archive, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you tomorrow morning for more of The Conversation. Have a good Monday.